I am in love. His name is James.
No, I said, for once telling the truth. Facebook pinged with a message, and my heart surged with the thought of talking to James. I should get back to my work. The message was not from James, but from my cousin, Amir. We had not seen each other since that time he came to America, but over the past few years we had reconnected online. How are you doing, cousin? Read the message. Not so good, I wrote. He was online, even though it was 5 in the morning there. I saw the dots as he typed. Tell me what is wrong. Inshallah, I can help. The words I could not confess to my father rose up in me, desperate for an audience. And my cousin, 10,000 miles away, the seed of it all, seemed not only safe, but like kismet, like fate.
3. Hunger. As they're finishing up at the urgent care clinic, awaiting Nathaniel's discharge papers, the doctor asks Freya for her number. And even though the doctor has provided ample evidence that he is both incompetent and a creep, and even though Freya's creep radar is so finely tuned she could sell it to the CIA, the request does something to her heart. She designated herself Nathaniel's emergency contact, and now the doctor is officially assigning her that role. Freya is never in charge of anyone. Someone has always been in charge of her. First her father, then Sabrina, now Hayden. She writes down her number for the doctor, a little embarrassed by this surge of good feeling. She is Nathaniel's emergency contact. For today, anyhow, she is in charge of him. She no longer cares about whether or not he will sue her or whether Haroon will sell her pictures. She is someone's person. After Freya hands him the paper, the doctor folds it into a square and deposits it into the breast pocket of his lab coat and with a smarmy smile asks, "You like martinis?" It takes Freya a moment to realize that she got it wrong. What else is new? And the doctor is hitting on her. Freya is an empty vessel once again. Emptier yet for having been, at least momentarily, full. Just like that, she's in a foul temper. Extreme moodiness is evidence of diva mode, per her mother. Feeling worse than she did after the miracle doctor sent her away with no miracle. Worse than she did in the park after she'd seen Alex Takashita's Facebook post. She said yes. Freya never gets asked questions she wants to say yes to. Freya is in charge of no one. Freya is liked by millions, needed by none. Fuck it. She no longer cares if Haroon has pictures of her on his phone. Let him sell them. Why shouldn't he cash in on her somewhere between buzz and celebrity status before it's too late? Someone ought to. Her mother was right. She should just go home and watch Scandal. Except, she doesn't want to go home and watch Scandal. She doesn't want to do anything. The last few weeks have been bleak. Whole, desolate stretches of hours. The thing that used to soothe her, logging on, chatting with her fans, or at least seeing what they were saying about her, now torments her. She can't stop hearing Hayden's prophecy. Your fans will forget you. Your numbers will drop. You'll go back to being like everyone else. So, she says to Nathaniel, where are you headed? Guess I'll meet my dad. Nathaniel replies unsteadily. This is the most she's heard him speak, so at least he isn't brain damaged. Though he still seems pretty dazed, and looking at him makes her feel bewilderingly homesick. Are you staying with friends? At a hotel or Airbnb? No response. Or does your father live here? My dad's taking care of that. Is it her? Or is he not making a lot of sense? She looks at Haroon, cocks her head to the side. He gives the slightest of nods. Maybe you should call your father, Haroon suggests. I don't want to worry him, Nathaniel says. I don't think you should be out wandering alone after a concussion, Haroon says. Right, Freya says, remembering something from a TV show. Was it Grey's Anatomy? She and Sabrina used to watch that together religiously. In case you fall asleep. Fall asleep? It's dangerous to fall asleep, Freya says. She has no idea if this is accurate, but as Hayden would say, the truth is how you sell it. You might not wake up. The doctor didn't say anything about that, Nathaniel says in slow, measured words. He wasn't even sure it was a concussion. The doctor was incompetent, Haroon says. When my brother, Abdullah, was concussed, he was told not to go to sleep without supervision, in case he had a subdural hematoma. If you get those, you die. Haroon turns to Nathaniel. You wouldn't want that to happen, would you? When Nathaniel doesn't answer, Freya answers for him. No, she says. You wouldn't.
Now that Nathaniel's head is clearing, he's more confused than ever. He understands what happened to him. The girl, Freya, fell onto him, and the other guy, Haroon, saw it go down. But what he doesn't understand is what they're still doing here. He gets why they didn't leave him in the park, though he wouldn't have been surprised or even all that disappointed if they had. And he understands why they took him to a doctor and even paid for the doctor. They felt guilty and obligated. But whatever debt there was has been paid. They're free to go. He's told them it's all good so many times. And yet they're still here. Which unnerves him. Almost as much as the questions they continue to fire at him. Because after warning him about his imminent death, which made him almost laugh, they started quizzing him about his plans, asking for specifics. Where's, when's, addresses, things for which Nathaniel has not prepared. Maybe we should wait until you talk to your father, Freya says. Nathaniel is not by nature a deceptive person, but he's learned a few tricks over the years to throw people off the trail, to protect his father, to protect himself. Nathaniel pulls out his phone. Oh, look, he left me a message. I didn't hear the phone ring, says Haroon. The ringer's off. They don't make it easy, these two. Nathaniel excuses himself and puts on a big show of listening to the voicemail and calling his father back and talking to dead air. Yeah, he says to his father, saying how great it is to be in New York City. Me too, he replies when his dad says he's looking forward to seeing him. After a minute or two of this, he hangs up and returns to the others. So? Haroon says. He says we can meet earlier, Nathaniel says. Now? Haroon asks. Nathaniel nods. Maybe we should escort him up there, Haroon says to Freya. Hand him off. It's getting worse and worse. Why are they so persistent? Well, not now, Nathaniel says, tripping over his story. In a few hours. He's busy. Busy? Did you not tell him you were concussed? Haroon demands. He seems affronted by Nathaniel's father's perceived neglect. And Nathaniel feels that age-old instinct to protect his father flare up. I didn't tell him, he says. I didn't want to worry him. He expects an argument from Haroon, who has been a fierce interrogator so far. But he just nods at this, as if in agreement about the need to not worry fathers unnecessarily. Let me at least get you a car, Freya says. They've wasted enough time and money on him already. But if he accepts the car, they'll be done with him. Okay, he agrees. Where are you headed? 175th Street, Nathaniel guesses. Where are you staying? Freya asks. With friends of my dad's. They seem to accept this, but Nathaniel is still uneasy. What if they want to come with him? What if they want to meet his dad? What's the address? She asks. Why are they doing this? He's given them every opportunity to leave. Why are they making it so hard? He knows that they are nice people who mean well, but don't they know that once you start feeding a stray cat, it will come back, it will depend on you? He doesn't have an address. Can he make one up? Like 43 175th Street? Is that a place? My Uber's not working, Freya says, slapping her phone against her thigh. Reprieve. Nathaniel exhales. I can just take the subway. No, she says in a harsh voice. I'll put you in a cab and give the driver cash. She steps out into the street to hail a cab, and Nathaniel watches her. She raises her hand confidently, as if certain she will be seen. Nathaniel wonders what that must feel like. Though he's engineered his departure, he's already mourning the absence of this formidable girl, this persistent boy. He's seeing them disappear through the rear window of a taxi. He's feeling the leaden weight of his solitude. At least he'll see his father soon. Freya jumps back onto the curb, holding her foot in her hand, cursing. Droplets of blood fall on the sidewalk. A shard of green glass glints from her heel. Are you okay? Haroon asks. I guess there's a reason people don't go barefoot in the city, she says ruefully, hopping on one foot. That looks pretty bad, Haroon says. Maybe you should go back to the urgent care? No way. That doctor was a grade A douche, and he'll charge $100 for a piece of gauze. She glances at her foot. The blood is staining her jeans. Fabulous. I look like a homeless serial killer. Normally, Nathaniel carries a first aid kit with him at all times. He started carrying one after the thing with his eye. Probably a strip of gauze and some Neosporin wouldn't have changed anything, but it's better to be prepared. But he left his kit at home. He didn't see the point of being prepared. I can fix it for you, Nathaniel says. We just need some gauze and wipes. There's a pharmacy across the street, Haroon says. The three of them cross the street. A wobbly chain like before, but with the order shuffled. Where once a shaky Nathaniel was flanked by Freya and Haroon, now Freya is hopping between them. She keeps insisting she's fine, but that's a lie Nathaniel can see through. Haroon offers to get supplies, and so Nathaniel stays outside with Freya and her bloody foot. I'm so sorry, he tells her. Why are you sorry? She asks in a sharp voice. Because it's my fault. How is this your fault? I threw up on your shoes. You threw up because I fell on you, she replies. If anyone should be apologizing, it's me. No, Nathaniel says. No? Don't apologize. I'm glad you fell on me. Why would you be glad I fell on you? She asks. Because you can't fall on something that doesn't exist, he thinks. He may be feral, but he's not been out of the world so long that he doesn't know this is a profoundly odd thing to say. So he doesn't say it.
Inside the pharmacy, Haroon buys more supplies than necessary. To his mind, if he assembles the right first aid kit, he can keep Freya around for a little while longer, enough time to figure out how to get her in front of James, who's clearly blocked him and won't see any texts. And even if he did, probably wouldn't believe him. Once James sees Freya in the flesh, though, he'll have to understand that it's a sign that they should be together. He puts a bottle of hydrogen peroxide in his basket, a box of bandages, a roll of gauze, some medical tape, Neosporin, and a pair of scissors. He passes over the generic products for the more expensive name brands because it's Freya. Altogether, it comes to almost $30, and he pays from the stash of money he purloined from his trip fund. It feels good to do something slightly worthy with the money, even if his intentions aren't so noble. But he'd like to think that he would be helping out in the same way, even if it weren't Freya. Only maybe he would have bought the cheaper bandages.
As Freya sits on a cement planter, Nathaniel uses the scissors to extract the glass still lodged in her foot. He gently cleans the area with the hydrogen peroxide, and though he knows this must sting, Freya does not even flinch. Formidable, he thinks. He slathers her foot in ointment and slowly wraps the heel in gauze. He takes his time, because he is methodical by nature, but also because it feels incredibly good to touch another human being, and particularly this human being. It has been such a long time, and as he holds Freya's foot against his knee, getting some of her blood on the front of his jeans, where it will match the drop of her blood on his shirt from when he wiped her face before, he feels something hatching inside him. He pictures a bird, all tiny and helpless. He remembers when a nest fell out of the eaves of their house, and he and his father tried to save the chicks, feeding them with eyedroppers. "Hope is the thing with feathers," his father had said, quoting Emily Dickinson. But then the birds had died, and Nathaniel had realized that it was actually grief that was the thing with feathers. He doesn't want to hope. He can't afford to hope. But there it is, the fluttering in his chest, all because a pretty girl, a beautiful girl, with beautiful eyes, sad eyes, is letting him hold her bare foot as he dresses a wound that he himself caused. He doesn't want to hope, but he doesn't want to let go just yet. Is there some middle ground? A space where he can allow himself this bit of human kindness without getting too attached? It's so easy to get attached. 3 baby birds, a shoebox, and an eyedropper. They buried the birds not far from where Mary's ashes were scattered. His father had wept. Freya's foot is bandaged and taped, but Nathaniel can't quite let her go. Just a few minutes more. His father won't mind. He has lost the battle, and hope has won, and the desperation to get away has reversed itself. Because of a foot he can't seem to let go of, a foot that, miraculously, is still resting in his lap. He stares at the foot of this formidable girl and holds his breath, because if he moves so much as an inch, he will break the spell, and Freya will surely leave.
The spell goes both ways. Freya can't move either. Doesn't want to move. Nathaniel may be holding on to her filthy foot, but it feels like he's palming her heart. It feels like she has a heart. "Please don't let go," she thinks.
Nathaniel doesn't let go.
Haroon doesn't want to let go either. "Maybe we should get you some shoes," he suggests. Freya does need shoes, but more to the point, her buying shoes will buy him time. There's a store down the block.
"Shoes," Nathaniel says. What a brilliant idea. He could hug Haroon. "I need to buy you shoes." "Oh, that's okay," Freya says, pulling her foot back. "No," Nathaniel says, yanking her foot toward him. "I have to replace the ones I ruined." "I didn't even like those shoes," she says. "You did me a favor." He doesn't care if she liked them or not. He's the one who needs the favor. He needs this. Just for a little longer. Is it too much to ask? Probably. But he's asking anyway. "I have to buy you shoes." Freya's foot stiffens, and Nathaniel knows he's revealed a part of himself that must be kept secret. The wild, feral part that Dad said they could show each other, but not anyone else. "Don't tell your mother," because they wouldn't understand. Nathaniel tries to remember the person he once was. Athletic, even popular. He tries faking being him. "It's just the right thing to do. To get you new shoes, you know?" His voice sounds strange and foreign, like someone on TV. Is she buying it? Can he pass as his old self? Was he ever his old self? I really don't need you to buy me shoes, Freya says. She starts to pull her leg away, but Nathaniel can't let go. He's a drowning man, and her ankle is his life preserver. But she's pulling it away, leaving him no choice but to reveal the feral man inside. Please, he begs. Let me buy you shoes.
Freya doesn't need new shoes. At home, she has rows of them. Many of them, like the pair she threw away earlier, had been given to her in hopes of a mention online. It used to thrill her, all the freebies in exchange for her word. But now that she knows it all might go away soon, it's like wearing shoes made of lead. In any event, she doesn't need Nathaniel to buy her shoes. Certainly not $375 shoes, which was what the ones he puked on today cost. She wonders if he even has $375 to his name. She pictures his wallet, the lonely bills, the creased photo strip, the folded business card. She glances at his shoes, a pair of dirty canvas sneakers that she would bet $375 have holes in the soles. This is a bet she would win. And that's when she understands. He is her responsibility. He is, for today anyway, her person. She doesn't need new shoes, but she needs this to continue. So if Nathaniel wants to buy her shoes, she'll let him buy her shoes. Okay, she says. Let's get me shoes. Who is made happier by this statement? Haroon? Nathaniel? Or Freya? Hard to tell. The store Haroon pointed to is a chain, the kind of place Freya used to shop in, but hasn't in years because, dream it, be it. It's empty, and there are comfy seats inside, but Freya gestures to the bench outside. You wait out here. It comes out as a command. She's told that she can come across as imperious, bitchy. She's read people sniping about this. She needed us when she started out, but now she's too good, they write. No, Freya wants to reply. I still need you. But she wasn't permitted to respond anymore, and so the silence seemed to confirm their suspicions. Anyway, Hayden told her not to worry about it. Some early fans would always feel betrayed when their secret got out. This did not make Freya feel better. She didn't want to betray anyone else. But she doesn't want Nathaniel coming into the shoe store, because she has no intention of spending the $50 bill he's thrust into her hand. So she softens her voice and says, Girls in shoes can take a while. It's the first time Freya sees Nathaniel smile. Take all the time you need, he says, and he looks like he means it, which must be a first among the ranks of young men. Yes, no rush at all, Haroon adds. A second. She leaves them there and goes inside, surveying the inventory, inhaling the smell of new leather. See anything you like? The clerk asks. Before Freya goes out for an event, she and her mother consult a series of photographs a stylist has shot for them, different outfit combinations for different occasions, never the same thing twice. Sometimes she likes the clothes, sometimes she doesn't, but she always feels as though she's playing dress-up. That's the point, says her mother, who sounds more like Hayden every day. Freya scans the shoes and stops at a pair of orange flats with thick rubber soles. She flips them over. $80, but half off. When Nathaniel pressed the 50 into her hand, she took it, but only to placate him, figuring she'd find a way to give it back later. Still, it feels right to stay within Nathaniel's budget. "I'll take these in a size 8," she calls to the clerk. While she waits for the shoes, she pulls out her phone, but before she looks at it, her gaze is drawn to the window. Outside, Haroon and Nathaniel sit side by side, hands folded into their laps, like obedient children waiting for their mother. Looking at the pair of them, she feels another lurch in her chest. She puts her phone away. The clerk brings the shoes, and Freya slips them on. They fit perfectly. Freya pays with her credit card and returns to the boys. "I'm famished," Freya announces when she returns to the boys, even though she's not remotely hungry. "Where should we eat?" She uses her imperious voice in the hope that it makes it sound like lunch has been on the books for weeks. She's trying to hide the fact that if these two strangers say no, Freya, who has millions of friends, won't have a single soul to keep her company today. She looks at Haroon. He's been her ally so far today. Will he come along? "There's a diner nearby," he says, and Freya wants to hug him. "I've been there before. It's not too expensive. Not that you..." He stumbles and reddens. "The food's good, and they don't care if you stay a while." "Perfect," Freya says. Haroon stands up. Nathaniel remains seated. "Are you coming?" Freya asks. Part of being a good vocalist is making your voice project feelings you don't necessarily possess. So Freya makes her voice sound authoritative, even though she is sick at the prospect that Nathaniel will say no, and her whole flimsy plan will collapse, and they'll go their separate ways, leaving Freya all alone. "Unless you're not hungry," Haroon says, when Nathaniel doesn't answer. Freya wants to smack him for even giving Nathaniel the opening of an out. Doesn't he see how hard she's trying? How much she needs this?
"No, I'm hungry," Nathaniel admits.
Nathaniel is not hungry. He is ravenous. He hasn't eaten a hot meal in more than 2 weeks. More than that, he hasn't shared a meal with another person in 2 weeks. But that's not the kind of thing you say. Not out loud. Not when the going is, at least temporarily, good.
Nathaniel is hungry. Freya is ridiculously relieved.
"Cool,"
she says, toning down her enthusiasm now that agreement has been reached. "Let's go eat."
The waiter at the diner is a crabby old Greek whose rudeness never wavers, whether you order a cup of tea or a steak dinner, which James did one time for them to share. A mistake, in retrospect. It had the consistency of rope. Who administers a fisheye whether you eat and go within a half hour or stay for hours. For this reason, it was one of their favorite spots. James would flirt with the waiter, even though it never made a dent. Still, he was determined. "I can win anyone over," he said, giving Haroon a look to show just which anyone he was referring to. There's no reason to think he might be here, even though it's a Thursday. James probably didn't come downtown today. Why would he? But if he had, if he were here... Haroon imagines it, walking in with Freya, delivering James this gift. He would not be able to refuse it. They would kiss. The crabby waiter would finally smile. James isn't here. The waiter is frowning. The place is mostly empty. One old guy who's always at the counter, a booth full of girls. The table in the corner, the one they sat at because it was next to the bathroom and seemed the least desirable, and therefore the least objectionable to commandeer for whole afternoons of ordering only soup, is empty.
They sit down in a booth. A cranky waiter delivers the menus with a long-suffering sigh and slaps down three waters, sloshing them all over the Manhattan map placemats. The menu is a species typical of New York diners, which is to say pages and pages long with laminated pictures of food that are always much more appetizing than the real-life offerings. Haroon normally gets the soup. There is only so wrong you can go with soup. Also, a bowl of soup costs $5, and the cranky waiter is oddly generous with the crackers. Nathaniel stares at the smudged pictures of omelets and burgers and skyscraper sandwiches with deep concentration. Freya, who claimed to be so hungry, hasn't even looked at the menu. She's frowning at her phone.
"Order?"
the waiter asks, tapping his pen against the pad as if he has dozens of other places to be, dozens of other tables to service.
"I'll have the minestrone soup," Haroon says.
"Cup or bowl?"
"Cup?" The waiter grunts.
"You?"
he asks Nathaniel. Nathaniel is looking at the menu with a bewildered expression.
The same, I guess."
Ummi sometimes talked about what it was like when she moved to America to marry Abu. She'd studied English in school, but it turned out to be completely insufficient for carrying on actual conversations. She learned by parroting what the natives said. When Haroon realizes that's exactly what Nathaniel just did, he deeply regrets ordering the soup.
"I'll have a Cobb salad, no bacon, no egg, dressing on the side," Freya says,
looking about as pleased with her order as Haroon is with his.
"Two cups of minestrone and a dry cob,"
the waiter repeats, already starting to leave. He's halfway back to the kitchen when Freya calls out,
"Wait, I changed my mind."
Haroon braces for the waiter's ire, and sure enough, he returns with a murderous expression on his face.
"Sorry,"
Freya says, smiling at him, as if trying the kill-him-with-kindness strategy. It doesn't work for her, either.
"I'd like a grilled cheese on rye bread with tomatoes,"
she licks her lips.
"And American cheese. It has to be American."
"Salad or fries?"
the waiter asks. Freya hesitates for a second.
"Fuck it," she decides. "Fries. Extra crispy."
"Extra crispy?"
the waiter asks.
"Yeah, put them through the deep fryer twice."
The waiter appears horrified by this.
"And a side of honey."
"Honey?"
"For the fries."
The waiter looks even more horrified. Freya smiles. Haroon looks at Nathaniel, gaunt Nathaniel, and feels his hunger as if it were his own, though his appetite vanished when James told him to get the fuck out of his life. Knowing the risks, he calls the waiter back. By the look on his face, Haroon is fairly certain one of them is going to have their meal adorned with a healthy side of spit.
"I would like the same as her," Haroon says.
"You want what she's having?"
The waiter is incredulous, as if he knows that Haroon doesn't even like grilled cheese sandwiches.
"Exactly. Fries extra crispy."
"You want honey, too?"
"Sure,"
Haroon says. He looks at Nathaniel, thinks of Ummi doing as the natives do.
"Should we just make it three?"
There's a look on Nathaniel's face. Relief. Gratitude. And Haroon wonders why it fills him with shame.
When the food comes, Nathaniel is overcome by the force of his appetite. His last meal was 6 bags of airplane pretzels stolen off the card and hastily eaten in the tiny lavatory. He's nearly undone by the tastes of the food. The ooze of melting cheese on his tongue, the tiny caraway seeds that explode under the force of his molars, the delightful sweetness of honey with French fries, which Freya has insisted both he and Haroon try, holding the fry so close to Nathaniel's mouth that it is a minor miracle he doesn't eat her finger, too. It's only when he looks up and sees Freya and Haroon staring at him with similarly peculiar expressions that he understands he has done something wrong, revealed the wild man within him, Don't tell your mother. He looks down at his barren plate. He's devoured everything. The sandwich, the fries, the pickle, even the wilted lettuce that he realizes was meant for garnish. Meanwhile, neither Freya nor Harun has eaten even half of their sandwiches. He is mortified. He's been too long out of this world. He's become uncivilized. Just us, buddy. Wordlessly, Harun takes half of his sandwich and puts it on Nathaniel's plate. Freya does the same. Nathaniel protests, but they cut him off. I'm not hungry, Harun says. Neither am I, Freya admits. Nathaniel stares at his magically replenished plate. If you weren't hungry, why did you order all this food? He asks. There's a pause as Freya and Harun glance at each other. Then they look at him. Because you were, they say. Nathaniel excuses himself to use the bathroom. There, in a stall no bigger than the one on the airplane where he consumed his last meal, he pinches the skin above his nose to keep the tears from coming. Then he pulls out his phone and calls his father. When he comes out, something is different. For one, a cluster of girls surrounds the table. But the thing that's really changed is Freya. He doesn't know how to explain it, only that she looks like a different person. He steps tentatively closer and hears the girls squealing, recalling how the girls at school used to cheer like that when he hit a fly ball deep into left field, back when he was at least half a human. Oh my God, it is you, one of the girls is saying.
I told you so. I told you it was her, she tells her friends.
I know, but like, what is Freya doing in our diner?
Can we get your autograph?
The third girl asks, brandishing a pen. Sure, Freya says. A piece of binder paper is produced.
Can you do one to Violet, one to Mackenzie, capital M, capital K, and no A, and one to Gia? That's me.
Her real name is Gina.
Shut up!
Gia slash Gina turns to Freya.
Gia is my stage name.
Freya nods.
Is Freya a stage name?
Gia asks.
Nope,
she says.
You're so lucky to have such a good name.
Freya smiles a tight smile, hands the paper back.
I'm going to get this framed, Gia says.
Put it somewhere safe, Mackenzie says. It's going to be worth money when she becomes huge. To this, Freya frowns.
Not that I'll sell your autograph,
Mackenzie quickly corrects. When the autographs are done, the girls ask for a selfie. Freya has to get out of the booth to arrange herself with them. Nathaniel takes the opportunity to sit down next to Harun. What's happening? He asks.
They're fans.
Fans of what?
Freya.
Nathaniel is also a fan of Freya. He's become quite a big fan in the past few hours, but he still doesn't understand who these girls are.
Have you not heard of Freya?
Harun asks. Nathaniel shakes his head. Harun shows Nathaniel a video on his phone. There, on the tiny screen, but somehow larger than life, is Freya.
It's an older song, Harun says. It's James's...
He stops.
It's my favorite.
Nathaniel glances at Harun's phone, back at Freya, back at the girl on the screen.
That's her?
He asks Harun.
I know. Of all the people to fall on you.
But that's not what he means. He doesn't know how to reconcile this person on the screen with the person in the park who whispered his name, who knew things about him. According to Harun, though, Freya is apparently some sort of singer, known, beloved. He only half hears this because he's fixated on the person on the screen. How is she the same person he's been with all afternoon? And why does this song sound familiar?
Where would he have heard it? As if the on-screen Freya has registered his disbelief, she stops playing piano and turns toward the camera. As she taps out a beat on the piano bench, singing without accompaniment, she once again becomes the Freya Nathaniel recognizes. In a warm, husky voice that sounds like the one that whispered into Nathaniel's ear before, she sings, "If you can't see, turn to me. I see well enough for the both of us." Everything around him goes quiet, and for a second, Nathaniel is back in the forest, blindfolded, and when he returns to the diner, he is certain that this song was written for him. Obviously it wasn't. He's never met Freya before. Then why would she, or anyone, write a song for him? But for that one fleeting second, he's as sure of this as he is of anything in his life. The girls, having procured their autographs and photographs, begin to depart. But after a brief whispered conference, they are back. "Okay, you can totally say no," Gia says. "But we usually come here with our friend Sasha. Like, every day. It's our spot. So normally Sasha would be with us today. But she's sick, so she didn't come to school." "And it's her birthday," Violet adds. "That's too bad," Freya says. "To be sick on your birthday." "I know, right? She's going to die when she hears what she missed." Freya nods, commiserating. "Could you, like, record her a message?" "Please," Mackenzie says. "Sure." Gia aims the phone at Freya. "Hi, Sasha. Hope you feel better and have a happy birthday." The girls exchange a look. "Could you maybe sing for her?" Gia asks. Nathaniel feels it, a lurch in his gut, before he looks up and sees that Freya, who has been good-natured and generous, suddenly looks pained. "I don't think so," she is saying. "Nothing major, just sing happy birthday." Freya hesitates, the look on her face traveling from discomfort to despair, a route Nathaniel knows so well he could traverse it blindfolded. "And we wouldn't post it on social media or anything," Violet promises. "I really don't think I should," Freya says. Nathaniel hears the song again. It's already familiar, something he's always known.
"Well, that was very rude," Arun says after the girls leave. "You were so nice to them, and they just kept asking for more." He sounds like James, who would sometimes monitor how people were reacting to Freya as if he were her personal protector, which, to his mind, he was. He'd discovered Freya singing "I Will Survive" the day his father kicked him out of the house, and he felt like she was singing to him. He'd posted something in the comments, not something he'd ever done before or since. "Not sure I will survive." And Freya herself had replied, "Yes, you will. You might not believe it, but I do." And from that moment on, James was all in. "And asking you to sing, do you even think there is a Sasha?" Arun continues. "I mean, you're not some performing monkey, are you?" He adds, even though 40 minutes ago he had imagined James being in the diner and Freya singing one of her songs for him and James forgiving him. "That must get so tiresome. Sometimes you must wish for everyone to leave you alone."
"This is not what she wishes. It's what she fears. Your numbers will drop. Your fans will forget you. And then what? Who's left?" Freya looks down and begins to cry.
Nathaniel reaches out and brushes the tear from Freya's cheek. "I see well enough for the both of us." And at that moment, Nathaniel hears well enough for the both of them. "You can't sing," Nathaniel says.
Freya has been ordered not to tell anyone about her current issues. Hayden has warned her that it alters the narrative they've worked so hard to create for Freya. Freya is tough. Freya is unstoppable. Freya is destiny. "Don't tell anyone, not your fans or your friends," Hayden warned. What friends? Her fans are her friends. She looks at Nathaniel and Haroon, staring at her with a mix of terror and tenderness. Staring at her not like strangers, but something like friends. "I can't sing," she says.
"What do you mean you can't sing?" Haroon is distraught. If Freya can't sing, everything falls apart. If she can't sing, how will he get James back? "I mean, I can't sing," she says. "When I try, when I even think about trying, my voice gets all strangled." "Maybe you're fatigued from being in the studio and recording your album." "I haven't been in the studio for 3 weeks," she replies. "But the photos..." Not 1 week ago, he and James had seen photos of her accompanied by updates about how well everything was going. "They were taken before," she says, "posted to keep up the facade, until I got my voice back." "But you will get it back. And finish?" She shakes her head. "Maybe not." Haroon imagines James finding out about Freya and the incomplete album. And though he only just met her and clearly has nothing to do with it, it feels like his fault somehow. Tears spring to his eyes. As a child, he wept so often that his older brothers teased him and Ummi scolded him. "Why do you cry so much? Not even your sister cries so much." Without anyone telling him, he knew that tears carried his secret the way blood carries DNA. He learned not to cry. Even with James, he did not cry. Not even when James did, and he thought it would kill him. "Hey," Freya says, wiping her own tears. She puts her hand on his, and Nathaniel puts his on top of Freya's, and Haroon savors the weight of it like he would a heavy blanket on a cold night.
"It's not your problem. You don't have to worry about it."
But she's wrong. She might not be his solution, but this is his problem. "But James loves you. He's your biggest fan." Freya smiles sadly. Nathaniel finishes chewing the rest of his second grilled cheese sandwich.
"Who's James?" Nathaniel asks.
"He's my..." Haroon begins.
What Haroon should say is that James is his ex-boyfriend, because as of last week, get the fuck out of my life, that's what he is. But Haroon has never once claimed James as his boyfriend. He's never told anyone about this boy he has been in love with for the past 18 months. Even when he told his cousin, he hadn't said the word boyfriend. He'd never said James's name. And it doesn't seem fair to say he's his ex-boyfriend when he never even got to claim him.
"My boyfriend," Haroon says. "And he's totally obsessed with you, but not in a creepy way."
"Oh yeah?"
Freya sounds amused.
"Yeah.
And it's like he's been uncorked, and outflow all the things he has never been able to tell anyone about James. About how James believes in the best in everyone, and how he hates the cold, and how he claims he can take any 5 ingredients and cook them into something delicious, a feat Haroon has never actually seen performed, though he has tasted the evidence of it, the plastic containers full of stews and pastas James has cooked for him. And how, when he was young, their apartment came with a shower curtain that was a map of the world, and how he used up all the hot water memorizing all the countries, even ones that no longer existed, like Yugoslavia. And how, even though he's never left the tri-state area, he has the most powerful wanderlust. How on the cold days, he and Haroon pretend they're traveling to the faraway places. And he tells Freya about James's devotion to her, careful to temper his fandom the way James himself once had.
There's something you should know about me, he told Haroon. And Haroon had steeled himself for some kind of deal-breaker. I have a boyfriend, I am a space alien. But instead, James had confessed that he had a kind of strange obsession with a singer. He told Haroon how he had come across the Sisters K covering I Will Survive the very day his father kicked him out of the house, and felt as though Freya were singing directly to him. And he wrote to her, and she replied.
There have been thousands of comments, but Freya remembers that one. She remembers writing back to that boy. She remembers reading his note and thinking of the night she realized her father wasn't coming back, thinking she wouldn't survive. She had, and so would he. She looks at Haroon, at Nathaniel. Unlike her mother or Hayden, she does not believe in anything resembling destiny. But at that moment, it's hard not to believe that the three of them were meant to meet. The Order of Loss, Part 7. Freya. Hayden hadn't called us back for 6 months. Mom tried to remain positive, because she now read everything about him. She knew he was in the studio with Melange, and after that, on tour with Lulia. When he's working with an artist, he's completely immersed, Mom declared. When it's your turn to be in the studio with him, you'll be glad about that. Not gonna happen, Sabrina said with her usual certainty. I nodded and pretended to agree. But though my sister was usually right, I could sense unfinished business. I kept hearing his question. Are you hungry enough? He'd asked me this question. I hadn't answered. But at some point, whether it was to Hayden or someone else, I knew I'd have to. We went back to doing what we'd been doing. Weekly video drops of new songs, daily photo posts. Mom storyboarded things out weeks in advance. Our numbers continued to climb. If Mom's optimism wavered, she didn't let it show. He'll call, she said. When finally his office did call, requesting a second meeting for the very next day, Mom was triumphant, as if Hayden had been on the verge of discarding us, but she'd mentally dreamed us back into contention. He asked for much more this time, she said, reading through the notes she'd taken. He wants analytics across platforms, accounting of all endorsement offers, licensing. Oh, and he wants to hear something new from you, an original song, not yet posted. We don't have anything ready, Sabrina said. We can't just pull a brand new song out of our asses. What about The Space Between? Mom asked. That was a song we'd been working on. Mom went back to her notes. Let's see. His assistant says he wants to hear something unique and... Mom shuffled through her notes to get the words exactly right. All his own. All his own. A warning right there. I guess we'll have to do The Space Between, Sabrina said, sounding defeated. He might have given us more time. Actually, I began, I have something else. No, you don't, Sabrina snapped. That was Sabrina through and through. If she didn't see it, it didn't exist. Mom looked at me. When I didn't say anything, she said, If you've got something in the works, let's hear it. Yes, Sabrina said scathingly, let's hear it. Actually, you already have, I told Sabrina. What? Little white dress? The one you called a pathetic piece of sentimental crap? I pulled out my phone and opened the audio file. Sabrina's normally impassive face flashed with so many emotions at once. anger and disgust and hurt? You recorded that without me? Not the whole thing, I stammered. Just some vocal and percussion of the chorus and the bridge. Because I thought if you heard... She cut me off with a flick of her hand. There's nothing that will make me change my mind about that song. I was used to Sabrina's strong opinions and her veto power, but something about her high-handedness pissed me off. And that was before she said, Look, I'm the only one who'll be honest with you, and the truth is, you're a weak songwriter. Your stuff is so sentimental, so young, makes you sound like an amateur. I'm 17, and last time I checked, we were both amateurs. Isn't the idea for us to take it to the next level? Well, not with that song, we won't. Why are you acting so jealous? She interrupted. She barked out a laugh. Jealous of you? Controlling was what I was going to say, but jealous worked too. Let's just take a beat. Mom turned to Sabrina. Can we at least hear it? Even when it was my song, it was still the two of them. It would always be the two of them. Sabrina slumped back without raising any more objections. She glared as if daring me to touch my finger to the play button. I hit play. All that I said I wanted was a little white dress. All that I said I needed was a little white dress. Oh, do you remember? We used to sing. Eshururururu, 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 hushabye, hushabye, hushabye. There were two more verses, but with Sabrina glowering, I couldn't bear to play them. I turned off the recording. You get the idea, I told Mom. Mom looked astonished, as if she didn't quite recognize the song or the person singing. Well, she said, it's certainly different. It's not arranged, but I was going for a more stripped-down sound, I said. Maybe just percussion and some piano? It is unique, Mom said. With the Ethiopian melodies in there? I imagine Hayden hasn't heard anything like that. She was warming to the song, I could tell. So could Sabrina. She put her foot down. I'm not singing that. Honey, Mom said. Let's be professional about this. Professional? How is airing Freya's daddy issues in front of Hayden Booth professional? What are you talking about? I yelled. It's been 7 years, she said, tapping her chest. Get over it. You get over it, I shouted. Maybe I will. Maybe I'm tired of taking care of you. That's what you call it? Because I'd call it undermining me or backdrafting off me. When I got angry, I boiled. When Sabrina got mad, she froze. It was one of the millions of things that differentiated us. But at that moment, the weather changed. Sabrina blazed with a fury that set the whole room on fire, before it sucked in on itself and her face went blank. Her voice went icy. If you sing that song, she told me, you sing it alone. We agreed to sing The Space Between, and practiced all night without actually speaking. We were still not speaking when we drove down to Hayden's offices the next day. But the minute the elevator doors opened, my anger evaporated, and I was left with a weirdly homesick feeling. I wanted to take it all back, to sing as we had that night in bed, or to clasp hands as we'd done last time we'd faced Hayden. But Sabrina stood with her arms rigid, her fists balled. her face statue still. Mom checked in with the assistant. Sabrina and I sat down. Sabrina, I whispered.